Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we're welcoming our guest from the OTC markets. It's Jonathan Dixon. He is the Vice President of International Corporate Services for the OTC Markets Group. So, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hello, great. Thank you very much for having me. Excited about this. Yes, been very well, thank you.
Good. No, it's good to be speaking to you, Jonathan. The OTC markets, personally, I don't know a whole lot about, but I do know a couple of companies I'm aware of listed on London that have dual listed on the OTC, and it has really been transformational for them and the performance of their share price, giving them that exposure to the American markets. And of course, we've got Kenny joining us as well. Kenny, how are you?
Yep, all good, all good. Great to have you on, Jonathan. We've got this unusual orange thing in the sky in Scotland at the moment, and it's very, very warm. So we're going to take it as long as it lasts, because no doubt it'll be pouring the rain tomorrow. Hopefully, you've got the same weather down in London.
I was going to say you could send it down this way for the bank holiday if you like.
No, it's unusually warm, so yeah. Like I say, we just enjoy it while it lasts. But no, it's great to have you on the podcast, Jonathan. And obviously, I'll echo what Mark said about the OTC markets. It's something that I'm aware of, but I don't really know a lot about it. So hopefully, you're going to educate both myself and Mark and our listeners later on in the podcast. But what we would like to do first, as we do with every guest that we have on the podcast, is we like to sort of dig deep into your past, almost like a deep dive. You can go back as far as you want, tell us where you grew up, what your childhood was, education, university, what your first job was. And then you can sort of move you through your career, tell us about your successes and failures, because failures are good, because you learn a lot about failures as well. So really, it's over to you, maybe, Jonathan, for the next 10 minutes, just to introduce yourself, tell us a bit about yourself, and sort of lead us right up to the journey to the OTC markets.
Yeah, thanks, Kenny and Mark, and I appreciate you putting the time with me today. So, yeah, I guess it's not particularly interesting, but I'll give you a whistle-stop tour of my life. I was born in the Middle East along with my two brothers. My dad had a long banking career in various parts of the Middle East, from Doha, Abu Dhabi, Sharjah, where I was born, Dubai, Bahrain, amongst other places. Lived there till I was 9 years old, and then I was unceremoniously sent back to boarding school here. I give my dad a bit of stick about it. When I was nine, just at the end of the Gulf War. And had a great time at boarding school over the years. It was good fun up until 18 years old, and then off to university, St. Mary's College, University of Surrey in Twickenham, which had a great 3 or 4 years there, studying history and playing rugby and doing all the good things that you do at university, which was great. And then my career from there, it's kind of a strange one. I didn't really anticipate getting into finance in a big way, and it kind of just happened as nature took its course. But I ended up going into stockbroking from university, and really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the market. It's got a good understanding of how the world works. And as time progressed, I decided to move into investment management. I spent 10 years at Redmayne Bentley as a stockbroker and latterly an investment manager, managing sort of investments for mainly private clients, charities, etc., cross-border as well, which was good. And then as time went on, the OTC Markets Group, I noticed, were becoming more and more, getting a bigger profile, I should say. In Europe, I started to keep an eye on, obviously being an investment manager and stockbroker, you're staring at your Fidessa trading platform all day, and you're seeing these tickers that end in F and Y, and you're wondering what they mean. And after a while, you realize it's securities which are quoted on the OTC market. And it just, that sort of caught my interest. And then as time developed, I noticed that OTC Markets Group, which are based in New York and DC, we're looking to set up a office in London to look after and develop their European client base and help sort of grow visibility and trading volume for the UK and European issuers. Mm-hmm. And before I knew it, I was on a plane to New York. I was with basically just getting in a firm understanding of the way of the world from the OTC markets perspective. And then a month later, I was back in London and the rest is history. We set up the office 3 years ago, nearly 3 years ago now. So I'm sitting here on the South Bank just behind Sea Containers House. And that's where I am now.
All right. Interesting. Obviously, we'll come on to the OTC in a few minutes, but can I just drag you back to ESI and the childhood? I mean, the closest I've been to the Middle East has been through Dubai Airport 4 or 5 times, which is an adventure in itself. What was it actually like growing up as a child in the Middle East? And I think you said that I'm going to assume it was the first Gulf War was on at that time.
Yeah, that's right. So my dad was a manager for Grinley's Bank, which were latterly were taken over, I think it was ANZ or Standard Chartered. But Dubai then was, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, is nothing like it is now. There was one high rise, which was the World Trade Center. And that was it, really. There was a bunch of expats, not many. And it's just grown and grown and grown. Obviously, the oil boom really kicked in at that point. And it was, it was a very, very different world to what it is now. It's and along with the other sort of Abu Dhabi's the same, Doha's the same, sort of smaller cities in the Gulf region which just hung on the back of the oil boom, really.
Yeah I keep threatening to go to Abu Dhabi or actually into Dubai, but like I say, I just seem to be transiting through the airport. But it does look amazing when you're coming into the airport and you can see it all unfold in front of you. It's just stunning. The amount of, as you say, the amount of buildings that's been up and infrastructure that's been up in the last 25, 30 years. It's unbelievable. But OTC, I think, I mean, most people know it's a North American based marketplace, but obviously it's got a wider reach than that. It'd be probably the best place to start, Jonathan, is just give us a sort of high level view of the OTC market and what services it provides.
Yeah, no, you're right, Kenny. It's a relatively unknown, and I'll go into some reasons for that as well. But the OTC market, very much like the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, we are the third stock market, if you like, in the United States. We're not an exchange. We're not a national exchange, but we are a stock market or very much a technology firm as well. But we do play quite a unique role in the international landscape. And the primary function of our market is, we have a lot of US primary listed issuers, but the real value, in my opinion, and I guess sitting here in London, probably why I would say that, but it is for the international issuers. But just to give you an overview, there's probably about 110 people at OTC Markets Group, spread between our New York Market Center, where I guess is about 90, and the rest are down in compliance in Washington, D.C., which is obviously near the SEC and FINRA, so for obvious reasons. So that's the OTC market. I guess from an international perspective, which is, Mark, you touched on it earlier around a couple of companies that you've noticed in London. So to give you the primary function of the OTC Markets Group, from an international perspective, is if you have your primary listing, if you're a public company and you have your primary listing on a qualified foreign exchange, such as AIM, Aquis, ASX, TSX, Euronext, Deutsche Börse, for example, you qualify in most part for something called, and this is a bit of a mouthful and don't get bogged down in it, but it's called the 12G32B Foreign Private Issuer Exemption. Now, it's a relative unknown, but what it means is you can have a US dollar quote in US market hours for US investors of your ordinary share from your home market without the requirement to file with the SEC, comply with Sarbanes-Oxley, or reconcile to US GAAP reporting. So what you're doing is, in effect, is you are accessing the entire US market by relying entirely on your home market disclosure because the SEC, working with OTC Markets Group, recognizes the quality and the financial standards of the likes of the LSE and Aquis and Deutsche Börse and Euronext. So they give you this exemption where we can open up the US for secondary market trading. That's the primary function for international issuers. Now, on our market, there are three markets within our market. There's the pink open market, which a lot of people have heard of. You know, a lot of people think of pink sheets, and broadly they're correct. That's right. It is an open market, and it does have dark distressed securities. So if you get a company which sort of delists off NASDAQ or New York, sort of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac situation where it hurts, that what will happen is they will land on that market. But it also provides a function. You know, Rolls-Royce and Nestle's level one ADRs trade on there. So that is also a function. Sorry, their ADRs trade on there. So that it does create a function, because there is a misconception that US investors can buy AIM securities. They can buy Aquis securities. They just simply can't. The mechanics are not in place. You know, we can't set up, or it's very, very difficult for us to set up an account, a US brokerage account. And US investors can't open an account with Hargreaves Lansdown, for example. It just doesn't work. So what we do is we've created this conduit where we can open up US secondary market trading for US investors. Now, I just touched on the pink market. That is an open market, you know, and I guess there's around sort of 9,000 securities which trade on there. But then we have the two main markets. There's the OTCQB venture market. This is in FINRA and SEC regulated market. This is where there must be 20 AIM companies which trade on there now, for example. Again, it's regulated by the SEC and FINRA, and it has market standards. So you have to go through an application process, albeit, you know, most of the time companies qualify by virtue of the fact they have their primary listing here. What it does do is it just gives these, for example, UK issuers, the opportunity to dip their toe into the US and grow visibility and increase sort of trading volume from there. So give you an idea, some of the UK companies which trade on there, I guess, Naked Wines, Adriatic Metals, Westmount, Blackbird, Zephyr, Phoenix Copper, Applied Graphing Materials, Myriad Advertising. These are some of the AIM companies which trade in QB and QX. On OTCQX, which is the market above that, we call that the best market. Market is, it does cover some of those AIM companies that I just said, but it's the likes of Tesco's, Anglo American, Imperial Brands, Sainsbury's, EasyJet, Tate & Lyle, Britvic, these big international issuers that absolutely want to be able to be bought by US investors, but they definitely do not want to register with the SEC. So what we've done is created this conduit where the vast majority of the banks and brokers which take the NASDAQ trade feed also take OTC, QX, and QB. That's kind of a whistle stop tour of that. Apologies. I know it's a kind of rammed that down your throat a little bit. Apologies.
No, that's perfect. It gives myself and Mark an understanding of what you guys offer. I mean, one thing that I've always struggled to get my head around. So, you know, I'm Joe Bloggs company listed the name and a Joe list on the OTC. Where do the shares, you know, how does the OTC get supplied with their shares? You know, how does that come about? No, does it drain the swamp from London, for want of a better term, or whatever country they're issued in? How do the mechanics of that work, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's a really good point, Kenny. And everyone always thinks ADRs, and it's important to think ADRs because it's also important to recognise that ADRs are not a trading mechanism. They're a function of settlement. Brokers and banks in the US will go wherever the liquidity is, wherever it's easiest to trade and settle the security. So as I mentioned, we are the market for all level one ADRs, but for the sub 1 billion and even bigger companies, what we tend to find is we set them up with the ordinary share out of their home market. So what it's doing is the vast majority, the bulk of trading, which happens in the US, will trade, print and settle in, you know, for this case, for example, London. It will trade, print and settle in London, boosting home market liquidity in London. So I'll talk you through the trade mechanics a little bit. So let's give an example. Maybe Helium One Global trades on, recently joined our market probably 3 months ago, joined the OTCQB venture market. So they're trading about 13 pence on AIM. So what you'll see in our market is there'll be a US dollar conversion, which is roughly 18 cents. There'll be a bid and offer in that market broadly reflecting that for US investors. So what happens is, for example, yesterday, Virtu, StoneX, Citadel, MCAP, Maxim Group, and GTS Securities, you know, there are a few of the market of the 98 market makers which actually quote in international securities in our market. They are creating a bid and offer spread of that ordinary share from London. So the actual mechanics of it are, let's assume Mr. Smith at Merrill Lynch in Chicago wants 10,000 shares of Helium One Global. Merrill Lynch will shoot that to our market. That will hit, for example, let's assume Virtu at the top of the box. Virtu will take that. They will shoot that straight into London. This all happens, you know, sort of not light speed, but pretty quick. They will shoot that to London. Virtu will lay that off in London, and they will trade, settle, print in London. They will essentially source that security from London. That will sit on the local register in London, and there will be a book entry for Mr. Smith in Chicago at Merrill Lynch. He's got 10,000 shares in Helium One Global in US dollars. He has the same rights. If they were doing a dividend, he'd get the dividends in US dollars. That's how that operates. So that's, broadly speaking, how the trade mechanics works. If it's outside of London hours, same principle. Spread will widen marginally. It's rarely prohibitive, but it will margin because those market makers got to cover themselves. Merrill Lynch shoot that to Virtu. Virtu will hold it as principal overnight, effectively going short. And when London opens the next morning, they will lay it off. Again, trade, print, settle in London, sits on the local register in London and boosts home market liquidity. That's the trade mechanics of how the ordinary share works. You will notice that in our market, there are all the tickers are five letters. For example, Helium One is HLOGF. F indicates it's the foreign ordinary share. If it was a Y, that would indicate it's an ADR. So you'll see for most of the AIM companies, for example, and the smaller LSE market cap companies, we set them up with the ordinary share. Argo Blockchain was a good example. That we set them up with the ordinary share, and it did help a lot with the liquidity back in the home market. So that's the trade mechanics broadly.
So you set it up with almost the same ticker as what's in London, so it's easier for people to understand.
Yeah, we try and make it, as long as that ticker's available with FINRA, FINRA is the broker-dealer regulator, as long as that is available, i.e. NASDAQ or New York don't have it, then yes, that most cases that will be available.
Okay, and what are ADVs when you talk about that?
ADRs.
ADRs even, yeah.
Yeah, American Depository Receipts. So the American Depository Receipt is traditionally, before it was this sort of fluid mechanism of trading the ordinary share, the American Depository Receipt is a form of settlement. So you know same way that here we have CREST. Effectively what the four ADR banks, which are Citi, JP Morgan, Bank of New York, which tend to do the most, and Deutsche Bank, what they're doing is they're actually taking security. They're taking a chunk of the security from the home market and making that available. It actually sits in the US with that depository bank. So that's what it is. It's a depository bank. And they effectively work as a sort of a quasi-registrar. And the shares are held there. There are a number of the companies in our market will have two lines of security. They'll have both an ADR and an ordinary. And what I mentioned earlier about the American Depository Receipts is if there's liquidity at the ADR bank and it's easy for that broker, say, for example, Merrill Lynch, to trade into that, they'll go there. If there's an ADR set up, if there's enough liquidity in the home market in London, they'll come here. It's just whatever is the easiest and most efficient way of doing it. So they both provide a function and they're both functions of settlement.
Okay. Well, that explains that very well. So you've got the OTCQB, which is sort of a venture market, more for, I guess, AIM kind of type companies in London. Then you've got the OTCQX, which is more for the blue chips, giving the American investors opportunity to invest in those securities. And the pink open market, is that then, strictly speaking, is that all US-based? What sort of companies are listing on there?
It's a real wide range of security. So, like I mentioned, Rolls-Royce and Nestlé's ADR trade on there because that's how their trading function works. They're not an OTCQX. However, you will probably find around 250, I'd hazard a guess, AIM companies on the pink market that probably don't know they're even there, despite my best efforts. The problem with the pink market is because there's a lack of compliance. A lot of brokers and banks in the US are reluctant to quote the security. If they will, they will go and get the three best offers. They will charge the investor a premium to do that. There are other parts of that market which are difficult. But at the same time, these AIM companies, for example, I'll stick with the AIM theme just for this, but it is the case with Aquis as well, I might add. So if a US investor, and bear in mind what I mentioned earlier about US investors not being able to buy AIM or Aquis securities, if a US investor wants to buy an AIM security and they can't, they will approach FINRA, the broker-dealer regulator I mentioned earlier, and what they will do is they will create a US dollar quote of that security on the pink market. The spreads are normally fairly wide. I mentioned earlier that they're unsolicited quotes only, so it's very much order driven by the brokers. As and when. So that's it. So it serves a function, but it's not a fluid mechanism in the same way that QB or QX. To give you a bit of an idea about how that would work, if you're standing on the street corner and you pull up in the US and you pull up your Fidelity account, your E-Trade, Schwab, whatever that app might be, and you put in the pink security, it may pop up, it may not. If it does, the spreads might be wide. It might say, call my broker. But if you're on OTC, QB, or QX, and you put in that AIM security, again, it could be anything I mentioned. Again, let's use Naked Wines as an example. You put Naked Wines in, it pops up with OTC, QX. You've got a bid and offer in US dollars, reflecting London broadly. You've got all the disclosure, all the news flow, all the RNSs which are coming from London, which we take and distribute into the US via the data providers which come into our system. So it broadly goes from you looking at your phone or your screen, not being able to buy that security, to the next day on QB or QX, it's like us going to Hargreaves Lansdown. Mm. That quote is fully available for US investors. It's just creating a fluid mechanism for them to be able to buy that security in London in this case.
And would you say is that the main focus of OTC? I'm just thinking of the different markets that are in the US. Of course, you've got the New York Stock Exchange, you've got the NASDAQ, which is more of a tech-focused exchange. Is there more of a focus with OTC?
So it's a funny one with regards to that. And I'll come back to that market in a minute, because I think there's one. I'll just finish off what I mentioned about the pink market. There's a really key component to the pink market compared to QB and QX, apart from the actual trading mechanics. If you are not on the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, OTC, QX, or QB, or made alternative measures, it is against US securities law to be recommended to be put in private client portfolios or have research distributed below institutional levels in the US. Now, that might not seem like a huge problem, but there is an enormous amount of managed money in the US. So if they're on the pink market, it's unlikely that you'll be able to be recommended for these private client portfolios or have research done. But if you join OTC, QX, and I'll use the Naked Wines example, if Raymond James in Dallas, like the Naked Wines story, they can start recommending it to all their clients. They become compliant in that state. On OTCQX, you get a blanket blue sky exemption across 37 US states. On OTCQB, it's 33 states, because what has happened is, and God bless America, this state by state basis, it's not on a federal level. What happens is, on a state by state basis, they recognize that the SEC has recognized the standards of AIM or Aquis. And what they will do is they will, again, give those states will choose to take that compliance file in, so to speak. That's probably the best way of putting it. We added Virginia last year, the year before, North Dakota the year before that, which I think adds about three people, but nevertheless, it's still another blue sky state. From the sector specific, and you're right, NASDAQ is very tech driven. We're agnostic as to the type of company, the industry, the sector they're in. What the primary function we do is by having that SEC exemption, if an AIM company, for example, went to NASDAQ, they'd be on the hook for heavy listing fees. They'd be on the hook for lawyer fees, accounting fees. But what we're doing is creating a sort of a cost-efficient, compliant, and light-touch way of just opening up secondary market trading. So So what we try and do is, in many ways, we can be that conduit, the full SEC filer. What you tend to find to happen, what you tend to find to happen with an AIM security that goes or a dual listing, and Kenny, you touched on it earlier. I might just mention the technical terms are cross-trade. It's not a dual listing. And the reason being is you're not issuing more shares into the US and you're not registering with the SEC, make it a dual listing. This is a cross-trade, just in case compliance are listening. But what that means is it's a cross-trade of the ordinary share or the ADR in this instance. But what it does is we have a number of companies graduate off QX and QB every year. But with AIM companies, one of two things happens normally. One, if a company goes for a dual listing on London, New York, or London NASDAQ, often, you know, it's a big world out there on NASDAQ and New York, and it's easy to get lost. And you're spending an awful lot of money in the US waiting for potentially, a big increase in your market capitalization, big increase in liquidity. But it doesn't always happen, and it often fails or it doesn't. On the other hand, it goes so well that it becomes very, very US-centric, that company. And they, because of the size of NASDAQ in New York, liquidity pulls across to the other side of the Atlantic, and NASDAQ and New York become their primary market and London loses it. What we're doing, in essence, is because the vast majority of the share volume prints back in the home market, the issue is, in some degree, are getting the best of both worlds because they're getting a full US, they can access all US investors without too much of a problem by trading on OTCQX or QB. But at the same time, the volume is coming back to London, which is, you know, the reason that we get on with the Aquis Exchange. We know London well. We get on with Euronext and Deutsche Börse and the ASX. We've actually got a very, very strong relationship with the CSE. Because they understand liquidity back to the home market. And if you look at some AIM securities, which may not have huge amount of liquidity, anything that we can open up from the US, which prints back in London, is only going to be good for both the issuer, OTC markets, and London Stock Exchange in this instance.
Yeah. And I suppose compared to a standard listing in the UK, the process must be a lot easier because obviously an IPO process in London, you know, can take 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, just as long as how many iterations a prospectus takes sometimes.
Yeah, so it's quite a straightforward process in as much as the it's an application. The key thing to remember is the 12G32B foreign private issuer exemption. I know it's a mouthful, but it's the key component to this. Being qualified under 12G32B, it's an application form which probably takes most issuers about 40 minutes to complete. And then there is engaging the an OTC sponsor. Now, that is a market maker or a FINRA-regulated lawyer, which we've approved. And they will do a bit of due diligence on the company and check that they're in good standing and they're on a qualified foreign exchange and give their opinion. And by doing that, that satisfies OTC markets and it satisfies the 12G32B exemption. So it's a very light touch process that normally takes from start to finish, probably about 6 to 8 weeks.
All right, and I assume that the costs are streamlined as well as compared to a London listing?
Yeah. No, so it's OTCQX. The only fee the issuer is on the hook for want of a better term, every year is the annual fee. OTCQX is $23,000. OTCQB is $14,000. There's also a one-off application fee of $5,000. But those are the two fees, $23,000 and $14,000. And what that does, that gives you that blue sky compliance. It opens up that secondary market trading volume from the US. There's a number of visibility opportunities that we've created as well. For example, a few years ago, we acquired the Virtual Investor Conference from PR Newswire. So an issuer can film live from London, for example, into the US. To a network of family offices, retail investors that we've marketed to on their behalf. That's about 90,000, I think, at the moment. With a Q&A at the end, so it's about half an hour. And then we give all the contact details. So if it was a family office in Kentucky, we'll tell you who it was and we'll give you the contact details for their investor outreach going forwards. There's podcasts. We've got a 30,000 square foot office in New York with a number of boardrooms. Whenever those issuers are in New York, they're welcome to use our market center, our boardrooms for investor meetings or cocktail parties, even whatever suits them at that point. But it's the ability to get in front of the investors in in our New York office. So there are a combination of things that we do to try and help drive that visibility, because, you know, we can switch the lights on, for want of a better term, for trading, but the issuers, the companies, you know, they should, best practices, you know, do everything they can to grow their visibility in the US.
What about European reach then, Jonathan? Because obviously you're not just trying to attract UK markets. You mentioned some of the UK market, European markets earlier on.
Yeah. So it's so we have a desk in New York which looks after the Nordics. So they are basically looking after that region. We've got a desk in New York which looks after Australia, New Zealand, and Canada by some distance, our biggest market. But yes, my remit is Europe. The companies, you know, we have got those, again, the big issuers in Europe: Adidas, Roche, Heineken, they, you know, Danone, Publicis, BNP Paribas. All these companies trade in OTCQX for the same reasons I mentioned earlier, and that's their position. But again, it's the smaller and mid caps which really look for that liquidity, which helps. So prior to the pandemic, you know, I was in France and Germany particularly regularly, at least once or twice a month. But then the pandemic hit. So I've pivoted to looking after London mostly, but now we can get moving again and do more in Europe. We've taken on some Euronext and Deutsche Börse sort of smaller mid caps this year, and out of Spain too, and Nordic. So yeah, I think London, because of the nature of the way London works, the relationship between London and New York, that was always going to be easier sell, for want of a better term. But, you know, Europe is a huge market for us. Euronext are a massive change. And with what they've done in Italy recently, they're just getting bigger and bigger. And it's very, very difficult to ignore them.
Yeah, you just touched on the investor base here. We kind of stole my thunder for the next question. I should probably ask that earlier on in the podcast. What is the size of the investor base in the North American markets? I mean, I can't even hazard a guess. I mean, it's got to be millions of investors, but just how many, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because in the US, there is, you know, self-invested 401k pension plans, for example. US, Americans, they tend to be a lot more engaged in the markets generally from a retail perspective. I think the first 6 months of this year in our market, we did over $1 trillion in US dollar volume, and we're the OTC market. We're not NASDAQ or New York. So there is a lot of volume which gets traded through all the markets. Excuse me. But I would say that it is a big market. It's a huge investment market. They're very geared up to sort of public markets and how they operate. And it's just a function of the way, you know, Americans are. I would just add, with regard, you know, slightly sort of moving on your question slightly, Kenny, but sticking with the US investors, I would say that, you know, if you're a BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, and you wanted to buy an AIM security, you're probably not going to use our market. You're big enough and set up to come into London and buy in the primary market. Our function is, if you are a retail investor, third and fourth tier investment bank, family office, 401k self-invested, everything below the real top institutions, and sometimes institutions are in our market. Oppenheimer, for example, are huge, and they're one of the market makers in our market. So are JP Morgan. These are the investment houses, the banks, and the brokers which tend to trade in our market. But in answer to your question, yeah, it's a huge depth of capital in the US. It really is, and it can, you know, seems to constantly get bigger.
Yeah, I think the younger generation, just with the ease of being able to trade now in the mobile phone, there's a whole new generation of investors out there. Most of them are engaged in crypto, but at some point when they grow up, they'll probably start expanding their portfolio and start looking at, you know, tech stocks, natural resources stocks, etc. So yeah, it's definitely a market to tap into. I suppose that's the summary of the podcast. You know, there's a North American market waiting there for UK and European issuers to engage with, and you guys are there to provide that conduit and function.
Yeah, I think it's just as I mentioned earlier, it's a light touch, compliant and cost efficient way of growing visibility and opening up to secondary market trading volume in the United States. That's kind of it, Mark and Kenny, in a nutshell. That's it's a fairly straightforward process because these companies are relying on their home market disclosure. They've done the hard work in the IPO, and we know an IPO is not straightforward. So once they've done that, it's just a bolt on. I'll just sort of summarize part of that. We often get the question, does this work? When I speak to companies all the time, they're like, yeah, it's great. We understand it, but does it work? So in 2020, we commissioned Oxford Metrica to do a study into the net effect of all companies joining OTCQX from either the pink market or no ticker at all. And this was done between 2007 and 2019. And the key takeaway and the key finding from it was, on average, there was a 26% increase in home market liquidity, which when you're talking to an AIM company and some of the less traded AIM companies or ones that have less visibility, which might be US centric and US investors might think, well, actually, we've got the pick of the bunch on NASDAQ or New York, but now we can buy an AIM security in the technology space or the resource space, which we don't think Brits know how to value. They'll try and fill that valuation gap. That's kind of what that role functions. We saw that with Argo Blockchain. That was exactly that. On day one, they were trading millions and millions of shares in the US. And because it was that time when Bitcoin was going bananas and US investors had the pick of the bunch, but they decided to get onto an overseas security because the opportunity had opened up.
Mm. And I wonder if I can maybe sort of finish on a point that's sort of just come to my mind, Jonathan. And Kenny mentioned it earlier about people being able to trade on the phones, young people just being able to trade very quickly on their phones. And we are very much in a world wide web world right now. Do you feel that is perhaps the way things might be heading with trading equities on stock exchanges? Because it's not easy at the moment. And OTC obviously are helping to bridge that gap between the US and Europe and the UK. Do you feel that that's the way things will head? That there will be, you won't even consider one day where the stock is traded. It will just be so integrated from all the exchanges that you can, you know, it will be as easy as pushing buy, sell on your phone.
Yeah, I think, Mark, I think it's a good point you make. And we talk about, you know, national exchanges like New York and NASDAQ and, you know, their reach and their power. But you're right. You know, the cross-border functionality at the moment isn't in place. But as time moves on and, you know, the technology is always increasing, always getting better and moving faster, that facility will undoubtedly be, you know, part of the function going forwards. Mm. You know, and particularly as we see a lot of exchanges moving towards blockchain. You know, that you start to see the start process there just because it is starting to, you know, make sense. The light bulb moment has happened where we've got these ledgers that can be cross-border on an international perspective. So, yeah, I mean, I think we are getting that way.
Yeah, stock trading on the blockchain, there's almost unlimited uses for the blockchain, isn't there? We're still very much in that dot-com era where we're still trying to find all the uses for it. Some are more practical than others, but I hadn't actually considered that. But, yeah, that would be one answer, wouldn't it? And you feel as well, you said earlier that Europe is really making strides. Do you feel Europe's going to become much bigger? And also London as well. I mean, do you feel London will still be the centre of, well, I know it's not in the EU anymore, but the financial hub that it was and probably still is following the likes of Brexit?
Yeah, I think it's easy for people to say that London will lose its might. And London is London. There are, you know, we're central, there's language, there's a lot of good things, there's the regulation. There's a lot of strong parts to London, which I think London will remain a powerhouse, particularly in international trading. And, you know, the world likes our regulatory regime. They do. It's structured, it's straightforward. I know there's some potential changes around the IPO process now, but, you know, it is a strong market. Europe will continue to push and drive, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that comes. And I'm sure there'll be more consolidation in the future as exchanges get bigger and they want to take more out. You know, Euronext taking on Italy recently is an example. I think that will happen. There will be more consolidation. So, yeah, I think, you know, Brexit is what it is. It's happened. And I think London will still remain in a strong position. But interestingly enough, we had some stats, and I think Jason in New York did an interview with, I think it was Bloomberg not so long ago. And he said, you know, the facts were after Brexit, we picked up a lot of trading volume off the back of Brexit, particularly in the large, in the mega caps. At the time, it was more to do with Switzerland. So our biggest issuers like Roche, we became a huge conduit for trading of Roche. So there's these things to think about. But yeah, an answer to your question, I think London will remain a very, very strong financial centre.
Mm. Okay. Okay.
Just one thing to finish off, Jonathan. I believe you guys have got, I'm going to call it a conference, lined up in December for sort of UK and European issuers.
Yeah. So what we tend every year, we didn't do it last year, obviously, but every year we have something called the OTCQX Issuers Forum on the 2nd of December this year in London. Everyone's more than welcome to reach out to me on it. But what it does is it's an opportunity for us to present to our existing clients, third parties that work with us, you know, the bankers, the brokers, the lawyers, and it's the ability for everyone to get together. The management team comes over from New York. Our CEO, Cromwell Colston, tends to come over. Head of corporate services, Jason and Chris, tend to come over, and a number of the team. And it's just a get together and a review of the year. We normally have a keynote speaker who will talk about sort of macro trends in the markets and developments in our market going forward. So yes, that's 2nd of December this year.
Excellent. All right. Well, maybe see if we can send Mark in some shape or form, hopefully. Excellent. All right. Well, it's great to have you on, Jonathan. Certainly learned a hell of a lot more about the OTC markets in the last 45 minutes than I have done in the last probably 2 or 3 years. So no, it's all about education for investors, and I think it's definitely worth the time and effort to put together a podcast like this, because it's timeless. You know, you guys can use it, we can use it, and it educates people, which at the end of the day is sometimes what you need to do for people to understand the process.
Absolutely. And thank you very much, both you, Mark and Kenny, for having me on. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I agree with Kenny. That is, I have a much better understanding now of OTC and what you guys are doing. So it's been really a myth busting podcast. So yes, thank you very much, Jonathan. And hopefully we can catch up in December if the event is still on. Obviously, we have to caveat everything these days with this virus that's going around. But all being well, we can perhaps meet up then.
Yep, that sounds like a plan.
Excellent. Okay,
great. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.